each of the people we've studied last night and today have been people who didn't start out as people that would have their stories told hundreds of years later. They started out as struggling, you know, they were unbelievers who God saved by his grace and then taught them lesson after lesson. And I hope, as Pastor said, you're finding practical application of these truths in your life. The story of Adoniram Judson is, I believe, the most compelling and interesting missionary story that there is. I love to tell it, but it takes hours to tell it. So, rather than telling the entire ministry of Adoniram Judson, I have tried to boil it down to a focus. And that focus is on his recovery of baptism by immersion. I will confess, though, that after we get through that, I couldn't bear to sort of summarize the rest of his life in about 15 slides. All right, so we are going to sort of cover his life, but there's so much that I'm going to have to discipline myself not to say. But I believe this is an important story. Pastor gave an excellent introduction. We've been tag-teaming on saying what the other person was going to say in advance. But baptism by immersion is 90% of the people we're going to be in heaven with later will have disagreed with us on this. And I think as Baptists, we need to understand that Baptists in parish systems where you've got an established church or you've got a dominant church and virtually everybody in the community is a part of that church and they're all baptized as babies, they all grow up in that church, and many of them teach you got to get saved later in the Reformed Presbyterian circles. Nevertheless, they believe in family worship. And I'm reading a biography of Charles Hodge right now, and that's a big thrust in that biography, is that tell the children that they should love God's word and they should love prayer and they should love Christ. And when you tell them that for these years, then at some point they'll get saved. It's like, well, maybe they'll think they're already saved. And so the Baptist view caused Baptists to be very much despised. Baptists were viewed as the people that were just out of touch. Don't you love your children? You don't baptize your children? You don't believe in family worship? We were viewed as sectarians and out of touch. But it's what the Bible teaches. And Adoniram Judson is someone who sacrificed a great deal to embrace this teaching. And I believe it unleashed a lifetime of magnificent ministry. So, I'm going to divide his life into a few parts. The first is discovering grace. That is, he's got to get saved before he can discover baptism by immersion of believers. So, 1788 to 1808 is baptized but lost. He's born in Malden, Mass. Notice the date, 1788, our country is 12 years old. The Constitution has not been passed yet. We're in the Articles of Federation. It's pretty rough and tumble in America, a lot of debt, hard time to live. He is born in Massachusetts where the Congregational Church is established. The Congregational Church is the old Puritan Church, which is the establishment church of Massachusetts and Connecticut and New Hampshire and Maine. And you pay taxes if you live there, and those taxes pay the salary of the minister in the parish church in your community. If that church has a problem with the roof, they do a tax, and you raise money from the community, and you fix the roof. So everybody in the community is expected to support that church. Adoniram's dad was Adoniram Judson Sr. That's how you get a name like Adoniram. He was a congregational minister, so he was part of the system, and he pastored the church there. He was Orthodox. Why do I say that? Well, because by the late 1780s, Unitarianism has swept into New England, and a lot of the old Puritan churches are drifting into this terrible theology. Harvard has gone Unitarian, and many of the Puritan ministers deny the deity of Christ. And so their idea of the parish ministry is baptize all the babies and teach everybody to be moral. But Adoniram is one of the ministers who has held on to Trinitarian orthodoxy. He loves Jesus Christ. But he's Congregationalist, so he sprinkles Judson as a baby and says, I baptize you. Judson is an unusual little kid. All right, I didn't intentionally pick five smart people this weekend, but Judson would fall into that category. And when he's 3 years old, Adoniram Sr. comes home from work in the office, and Mrs. Judson says, I want you to see something. And he pulls little three-year-old in and opens a King James Bible, and little three-year-old reads a page of the King James Bible to his dad. And his dad said, he's a genius! This kid is going to be famous! I've always wanted to be famous, and I pastor these little tiny churches, but not my son. He's going to be the president of Yale someday. And he probably could have been. And so he goes to college, to Brown College. Now, Brown's a Baptist school, but by this time, it's not all that Baptist. He went there primarily because it was closer to home than Yale and the other schools. And when he tested to get into the school, he was so advanced in his knowledge of Greek and theology that he was admitted into the second year of the program. And so he went as a 16-year-old, and he's already a sophomore. And so he's studying at Brown. And as I say, there's no evidence that Brown influenced him to be a Baptist. None at all. Very few students attending Brown at the time were Baptists, even though the Baptists had started the school. He graduates 3 years later, at age 19, as the valedictorian of his class. He's pretty bright. But while he's there, he falls into the company of a bunch of young men who have abandoned the faith, who don't love Christ and believe the Word of God is riddled with errors. One of those men was Jacob Ames. And Jacob Ames convinces Adoniram that the faith of his fathers is not for the modern age. It's a medieval faith. It's an old, ancient faith. If you want to be up to date, if you want to be modern, you've got to embrace the new way of living, and that's at best deism. That is, they would often talk about there being a power out there that got things started, but really it's practical atheism, and sometimes it was full atheism. Well, he graduates, and he keeps this a secret. He doesn't want his parents to know because he knows they're going to be utterly brokenhearted. He goes to Plymouth. He teaches for a year. In his spare time, he writes a math textbook and an English textbook. That is, he's just trying to fill time. He's kind of miserable. He doesn't want to be a teacher. He goes home, and he says, you know what? Let's let the chips fall where they may. And he tells his dad he's an atheist. And his dad says, my brilliant son, who's going to be the president of Yale, is an atheist? My son, who's been in my church hearing my preaching all his life? And he reasons with him. But he's not as smart as his son, and every argument Adoniram Sr. can give, Adoniram Jr. can smash. I mean, you're gonna explain to me how to be a Christian? Well, mom and sister didn't use the reasoning approach. They just wept for days. And Adoniram says, enough of this. And he leaves for New York City. He's going to have fame and fortune in the big city. No, it wasn't a very big city, but you know, relatively speaking. He thinks that if he gets to New York City, he can become a playwright. And he can become famous like Shakespeare, writing plays. Well, when he gets to New York City, he discovers it's an utterly miserable life. He can never quite make enough money. None of his plays are selling. He gets with a troupe of actors. They travel around to motels. They leave without paying their bills. Pretty soon he owes money everywhere. And he's in the pigsty eating the husks, and he's miserable. And so he decides, you know what? At least when I was home with my parents, they fed me good meals, and I'm sure they still would. So, really, straight out of Luke, he starts heading home. And then we have a story that's probably been told in sermon illustrations approximately 417,000 times. He's on his way home, and he stops in an inn and says, are there any rooms available? And the innkeeper says, well, there's one. But there's this guy in the room next to it who's dying, and you're probably not going to sleep well. And Adoniram says, I'm 20. I can sleep anytime, anywhere. Give me the room. Well, he gets in the room and he hears this guy thrashing in agony and in pain through the thin walls. And sure enough, it's a little hard to sleep, but then he goes quiet. He says, well, I hope you fell asleep. Justin gets up the next morning and asks the clerk, what happened to the guy that was sick? And he says, well, he died. And then Justin, for reasons that later he could not explain, said, oh, who was it? Like you would know. And the man said it was Jacob Ames. And his friend, who had led him into atheism, had died in the room next to his. And Judson, all the way home, is thinking, I don't believe. However, what if Ames is in hell? What if I'd go to hell? He gets to his parents' home a different person. He is a humbled person. He later said that that night changed his life. Now, some sermon illustrations say he got saved. He didn't get saved for quite a while later. But it changed his life. It redirected him. It humbled him. He needed a lot of humility. And the dad contacts this brand new school that has just opened at Andover. And he contacts the president and the leading systematic theologian there and says, you know, my son, have you heard of him? He graduated valedictorian at Brown. And they said, yeah. And they said, well, why don't you come and convince him to go to school at Andover? And so they did. They came to the Judsons' home and they sat down with them and they're a fledgling new school. They need students. It's a congregational school. And he said, you know, I'm willing, but there is a problem. Do you admit unsaved students to your seminary? And they said, we'll accept you as a special student. So they enrolled him. And they didn't just enroll him. They gave him an entrance examination. And he tested into the second of the 3 years. So they admit this unsaved young man into the second year of their program. And there he is, a seminary student who's lost. But he's now humbled. And he listens to godly professors like Dr. Leonard Woods. And on December 2nd, 1808, about 3 months into the semester, he went out into the grounds next to the college and bowed his knee before God and accepted Christ as his Savior. So knowledge was of no avail until the Holy Spirit humbled him. And when you're kneeling, the evidence all looks different. I mean, his arguments hadn't changed, but he realizes that there's a different kind of argument. So in 1808, he's now a different person and he begins preparing for mission. Because about 3 months after getting saved, he says, I believe the Lord would have me carry the gospel to the ends of the earth. I'm not sure where. He reads a book about this very exotic place called Burma. But there aren't any missionaries there. But it sounds like a fascinating place. It just sort of sticks that in the back of his mind. Samuel J. Mills, meanwhile, who's a fascinating fellow, one of those little spark plug kind of people. I talked about Athanasius being like 5 feet tall. Well, so was Samuel J. Mills. But Mills had been with a group of students in a small school in Massachusetts over on the coast, Williams College. And these students, in opposition to their teachers, had said, why aren't Americans going to foreign missions? And their teachers had mostly said, you guys, wait till you grow up and get a little maturity before you start changing everything. Fact is, Britain can afford missions. America can't. We're barely surviving. Look around. Our economy's in shambles. We owe all that money to the Netherlands and France. We can't send missionaries. And these college students are saying, I think if God wants us to do this, we can. And in 1806, they have a prayer meeting in a haystack. Judson wasn't there. He wasn't even a believer yet. But they have a prayer meeting in a haystack while they're out traveling back to campus. They stop in a rainstorm. Five people have a prayer meeting in a haystack. It doesn't usually go down in the history books. But all five of these guys form a mission society and begin pushing for missions. I love to tell aspects of this story to college students because these were college students who were getting no encouragement from the older generations. But they were not willing to be quiet. Several of them, including Mills, graduated from Williams and went to Andover for seminary, and they met this guy named Judson. Well, they had heard about Judson. Judson's brilliance was hard to hide. And they sort of gravitated to him, and he became the leader of this little group. And so they're talking about missions, Burma and elsewhere. And fortunately, I'm thankful to tell you that a couple of the Andover professors said, we appreciate the heart the young men are showing. Let's see if we can get some of the pastors on board. And a few of these professors and a number of these students start communicating with key pastors in Massachusetts, Connecticut, in the Congregational Established Church, and several of these pastors get on board. And they present a plan to the General Association of Congregational Churches to start a mission board. Along with Samuel J. Mills are Samuel Newell and Samuel Knott, who have also come to Andover from Williams and are good friends. And then Dr. Worcester, Dr. Baldwin, and Dr. Spring are leading pastors who buy into this and say, we will support it. God is raising up a groundswell of support. And by the summer of 1810, they established the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions. This is the first mission board in America for foreign missions. They had started one for evangelism of the frontier. But finally, it's a congregational mission board. It's an independent, it's not run by any particular church. It's supported by free will offerings, but it's mostly congregational churches. Then two more men join them, Gordon Hall and Luther Rice, and they've got what looks like a pretty good team put together here. Meanwhile, Judson, on behalf of the board, is traveling to different towns and presenting the burden, and they visit Bradford. And as they go to visit with a key deacon in the Bradford church by the name of Hasseltine, he meets Anne. Anne was pretty strong-willed. That is, she had a strong personality. She was a leader in her own right. She was attractive, and as of about a year before, she was godly. She had been kind of a wild soul for a while, and then the Lord saved her, and now it's about a year later, and she's really passionate about Christ. She never went by Ann. She was nicknamed Nancy. And that, in fact, they're going to be Don and Nancy at home. And there's Don, and there's Nancy. And they fall in love. And Don needs permission from the dad to marry and proceeds to pen what is arguably the most famous missionary letter in the annals of missions, so I have to quote it to you. This will give you a little bit of Judson's personality. He writes to Deacon Hasseltine and says, "I have now to ask whether you can consent to part with your daughter early next spring to see her no more in this world, whether you can consent to her departure and her subjection to the hardships and sufferings of a missionary life, whether you can consent to her exposure to the dangers of the ocean, to the fatal influence of the southern climate of India, to every kind of want and distress, to degradation, insult, persecution, and perhaps a violent death. Can you consent to all this for the sake of him who left his heavenly home and died for her and for you? For the sake of perishing immortal souls? For the sake of Zion and the glory of God? Can you consent to all this in hope of soon meeting your daughter in the world of glory with a crown of righteousness brightened with the acclamations of praise which shall redound to her Savior from heathen saved through her means from eternal woe and despair?" Can you imagine Deacon Hasseltine? Well, I guess so. So anyway, the deacon says, "Yeah, you can marry my daughter." But before they marry, they need money. They just don't have enough money to send missionaries. I mean, they're trying to get money, but everybody in New England is poor. And so they say, "Judson, we need help. Will you travel to the London Missionary Society," which is a congregational board that was started just a few years after the BMS, inspired by the BMS. "Would you travel there and talk to the London Congregationalists and see if they will give us advice and help in how we can put this together? Hint, hint, take money if they'll offer it." And on the way over, they're captured by the French, because the French and English are at war with one another. This is Napoleon's France. And he's taken to France and put in a French prison. And then he escapes. And some biographers make it extremely dramatic. I mean, I've read some very dramatic stories about how he got out of that prison. I don't think anybody really knows how he got out of the prison. That is, some biographers say somehow he got out of the prison. But he had time to kind of see how the other, how people in foreign countries who are suffering live. And he goes to London. And he talks to these LMS leaders and says, "Would you be willing to give us advice and money to support our independent mission?" And the British there say, "Why would we do that? But you can be a missionary for us. We'll send you to the Far East. Don't worry about the Americans. They're never going to amount to anything. But we'll support you." And so Judson goes back to America and says, "Hey guys, they wouldn't help us, but not to worry. They'll send us as their own missionaries." And the other young men are like, "Good." And the pastors are outraged. I mean, they were extremely upset with Judson. And after not being able to raise money all that time, the money just mysteriously came in over the next several months, because the Americans were not going to be shown up by these British. Judson always felt like, "Yeah, I got what I wanted." But they had hard feelings against him. That is, they knew he was a genius. But how dare you accept the support of the British? He didn't care. He just wanted to be a missionary. And remember, he's 20 years old. So they appointed him as missionaries to the Far East, September 19, 1811. And 5 months later, with all the money in, they had an incredibly eventful month. On the 3rd, they bid farewell to his parents in Plymouth. 2 days later, he married Nancy in a small ceremony in her parents' home in Bradford. A day later, with Newell, Knott, Hall, and Rice, they were ordained to gospel ministry, commissioned to service in the East, in Salem, at a really significant service. And then 13 days later, they got on a boat and sailed for India. They were on the caravan. The other ship was the Harmony. The Newells, Mr. and Mrs. Samuel and Harriet Newell, and Adoniram and Anne, Don and Nancy Judson, sailed on the caravan out of Salem. The others, Gordon Hall, Samuel Knott and his wife, and Luther Rice, sailed on the Harmony out of Philadelphia. Anybody want to guess why they sailed on two different ships? I mean, it's not that many people. Yeah, don't put your eggs all in one basket. I mean, this is a 5 to 6 month voyage, and a whole lot of ships never make it. So we want this mission. Now, both ships could go down. You can't put, you know. But that's what they do. And there's a painting of his departure. Virtually all of Salem and the surrounding area came out to say goodbye to him. And poor Anne had to take all the adulation. Don hated crowds and snuck on board the ship and didn't say goodbye to anybody. But they sail away. And they sail from there to there. And it is a long voyage, which gives you plenty of opportunity to read. And that brings us to the pivotal year, 1812. Samuel and Harriet Newell are with the Judsons. I've already told you this part. And I said 5 to 6 months. It actually ended up being that. I have 4 months here. It's 4 months if everything goes great. They actually got stuck in South Africa and were there for like 3 weeks working on the ship. But Judson had never even thought about infant baptism. Never questioned it. I mean, I was sprinkled. Everybody I know has been sprinkled. The only people who are not sprinkled are those weird Baptists. And there weren't that many of them, and they were spreading in New England, but most of the Baptists were down south by this time. They had headed south and just scattered like rabbits there. But in New England, not so much. And who wants to be a Baptist? They're the people who are out of step with everyone else. But he had some reasons for investigating the question. One of them was that while he was a student at Andover, he had realized that I'm going to be a missionary, which means I'm going to be a translator. I need to improve my translation skills. Well, one way to do that would be to translate the Greek New Testament into English. So I'll be working in the Greek. So he started doing that. He wasn't finished, and he decided to start over and this time make a special notice of every use of the word baptizo. He'd never done that before. So let's study baptizo. One of the reasons he wanted to continue that was that he knew he had been given a letter by the society to give to William Carey when he got to India. And William Carey's a Baptist. And William Carey's famous for being brilliant. And Judson thought, when I meet Carey, I'm going to have to discuss baptism with him. Now, he was wrong about that. Carey and the Serampore guys loved people to come out as foreign missionaries. And they never tried to strong-arm them into being Baptists. They were hospitable to everyone. And in fact, the Serampore missionaries were extremely embarrassed with what happened to Judson later. Well, they were happy, but they were embarrassed. But Judson doesn't know that. He doesn't know how gentle Carey is. And he's afraid that when he meets him, he's going to be embarrassed because he can't explain infant baptism. Furthermore, he had never served as a minister in his life. He had never had the position of having to baptize a baby. And so he decided, I've got to figure this out for myself. Well, there are two questions whenever you wrestle with baptism. Anybody know what I'm alluding to? Who and how? Exactly. Who and how? Whom should we baptize? How should we baptize? And really, they have been solved separately throughout church history, but the two biblical answers tend to coalesce. But it's not always obvious. That is, the earliest Anabaptists figured out the who. It took them a while to figure out the how. The earliest Baptists figured out the who. It took them a while to figure out the how. And so question one is, whom should we baptize? And Judson very quickly, I mean, his earliest thinking on this shows that he realized it had to do with the nature of the church. That is a church a covenant like Israel was? He had been taught that in Israel, all families were in the covenant by virtue of birth. So you're not entirely birth. You are born, and then if you're male, you are circumcised. And if you are circumcised, you're an Israelite. And then as long as you stay within the covenant by not doing something to be cut off from your people, you remain an Israelite. Now, at some point, you need to love Yahweh. If you don't love Yahweh, being an Israelite will not get you to heaven. But you're an Israelite in any event. And covenant theology, in very simple terms, said, well, this is Calvin expressly said, baptism has the same meaning and significance for the church that circumcision had for Israel. That's not a quote, but it's pretty close. And Judson said, is that right? Is that right? And here's what he wrote. I could not find a single intimation in the New Testament that the children and domestics of believers were members of the church or entitled to any church ordinance in consequence of the profession of the head of their family. Everything discountenanced this idea. When baptism was spoken of, it was always in connection with believing. none but believers were commanded to be baptized. And it did not appear to my mind that any others were baptized. Here then appeared a striking difference between the Abrahamic and the Christian systems. The one recognized the membership of children, domestics, and remote descendants of professors, and tended directly to the establishment of a national religion. The other appeared to be a selective system, acknowledging none as members of the church, but such as gave credible evidence of believing in Christ. This led me to suspect that these two systems, so evidently different, could not be one and the same. All right, you may have to think about that a little bit. Judson was not a dispensationalist. All right, dispensationalism as a system is not going to be worked out for about another 25 years. But all Baptist theology has dispensational tendencies within it because it recognizes the difference between Israel and the church. They're different. So I say that consistent Baptist thinking leads in a dispensationalist direction. The nature of the church will be a gathering of people who are nominal Christians because they've been baptized as babies, but hopefully they'll get saved. Or it's going to be a battle group of people who get saved and then join. And those are two completely different conceptions of the church. And Judson, while riding across the Atlantic, said, I think we've been getting the church wrong all this time. This isn't just a matter of an ordinance or a sacrament. It's the church that we're talking about. And which one is in the New Testament? Question two. Well, if I'm going to figure this out, I need to study the words. And he did a detailed investigation of the words bapto, which is the word used in the Greek translation of the Old Testament. The word baptizo doesn't occur there. The word bapto doesn't occur in the New Testament. But the two words are closely related. They're what they call cognates. They mean the same thing. And he discovered, much to his chagrin, that every time one of these words was used, without exception, it meant immerse, dip, or plunge. Not always immerse, because like you got the story of the two birds. Remember, you take the bird and you wring its neck and you put the blood in a bowl and you take the other bird and you bapto it in the blood. Well, you don't immerse it or you got two dead birds, but you dip it, you release it, but you don't sprinkle the blood on the bird. The word bapto is never used in a sprinkling context, never once. It's always dip, immerse, plunge. Even when it's used as a metaphor, it's a metaphor for something being dipped, immersed, or plunged. Now, Judson did not have access to all of classical Greek and all of the Greek of Bible times called Koine. If he had access, he would have discovered that every use of bapto and baptizo in all of Koine and classical Greek, going back as far as we have Greek, means immerse, dip, or plunge. There's not a single exception. Even the ones Presbyterians want to use, like the ship was immersed in the waves, doesn't mean water was sprinkled on the ship. It means water was washing over the ship. Even when it's a metaphor, this is what it means. You say, well, then how is it that the majority of Christians throughout the history of the church have gotten this wrong if it's so clear? And the answer is, if you miss the first question or baptizing babies, you will miss the second question. And so he studied New Testament practice. And they went down into the river and were baptized. And he drew this conclusion, which maybe as Baptists seems obvious. It's remarkable that he came to it. Throughout the whole New Testament, I could find nothing that looked like sprinkling in connection with the ordinance of baptism. It appeared to me that if a plain person should, without any previous information on the subject, read through the New Testament, he would never get the idea that baptism consisted in sprinkling. But now, think about what that means for Judson. It means repudiating his own baptism, a baptism administered to him by his dad. It means repudiating his dad's ministry. In case I forget to say it later. When his dad found out, he was brokenhearted, devastated. He's a congregational minister. He's part of the establishment. Less than 10 years later, through his own study of the word, he became a Baptist. And said, you know what? Because when he heard about it, he said, my son says that? I better study this. And he became a Baptist, had to resign from the congregational system. The repudiation of his mission sending agency. I mean, they spent all that time and raised all that money. It would be like us supporting a missionary who has been traveling around for 4 years to all the Baptist churches, and on the flight over to China, he as soon as he gets there, he emails us and says, sorry, I became an Episcopalian. The repudiation of his mission colleagues. As far as he knows, The Newells and the Knotts and Hall and Rice, they're all Congregationalists. And he sure does look cocky. He's 24 years old. And he's announcing that everything I've ever been taught by everybody I know is wrong and I'm right. It follows, inevitably, that I who was christened in infancy on the faith of my parents have never yet received Christian baptism. Must I then forsake my parents? The church with which I stand connected, the society under whose patronage I've come out, the companions of my missionary undertaking, must I forfeit the good opinion of all my friends in my native land, occasioning grief to some, provoking others to anger, and be regarded henceforth by all my former dear acquaintance as a weak, despicable Baptist who has not sense enough to comprehend the connection between the Abrahamic and the Christian systems? All this was mortifying. It was hard to flesh and blood. But I thought again, it is better to be guided by the opinion of Christ who is the truth than by the opinion of men, however good, whom I know to be in error. There it is. If we called it a day, there it is. All right. Yeah, it's going to cost a lot. But who matters here? But he's got a wife who's traveling with him. And Nancy wrote to her parents later and said, I tried to have him give it up and rest satisfied in his old sentiments and frequently told him if he became a Baptist, I would not. All right, when you study their story, Anne was a heroic figure, but she wasn't the kind of person to just say, oh, you want to be Baptist? Sure. And Judson said, I'll give you my notes. You got a New Testament. Study it. Study it. And she did. And she did not like what she discovered. He was a Baptist by the time they sailed into Calcutta. She was a Baptist within a couple of months after arriving. And Nancy embraced believers' baptism by immersion. And as hard as this was for Adoniram, Adoniram had a personality that kind of said, the world against Adoniram, Adoniram against the world. I mean, he's the kind of guy that if nobody ever likes it so much for them, I mean, he's going to have to soften over time. But he was fairly confident at 24. Anne was extremely gregarious and loved people. She wrote to her parents a very sad letter. It was extremely trying to reflect on the consequences of our becoming Baptists. We knew it would wound and grieve our dear Christian friends in America that we should lose their approbation and esteem. We thought it probable the commissioners would refuse to support us. Correct. And what was more distressing than anything, we knew we must be separated from our dear missionary associates and go alone to some heathen land. These things were very trying to us and caused our hearts to bleed for anguish. We felt we had no home in this world and no friend but each other. She wrote to another friend, can you, my dear Nancy, still love me? Still desire to hear from me when I tell you I've become a Baptist? We are confirmed Baptists, not because we wish to be. The truth compelled us to be. We'd be anything but Baptists if we could help it. But they're Baptists now. And on September 6, 1812, William Ward, one of the three great Serampore missionaries, you got William Carey, the translator, Joshua Marshman, the educator, William Ward, the printer preacher. They are the Serampore trio, three of the greatest missionary team in history. William Ward baptizes Adoniram and Ann Judson at Serampore. And Judson, to commemorate the occasion, gets up in the Serampore chapel and preaches a sermon on Christian baptism. Carey later said, this is the finest defense of believers' baptism I have ever read. And he encouraged Judson to publish it, and you can read it online if you're inclined to read a very, very good defense of believers' baptism. But when word got home, the board said, what? There goes Judson again. He's always been so full of himself. We had that whole English thing, and now he's doing this. Good riddance. No support. Furthermore, their friends, who were their friends, said, if you guys are Baptists, I don't see how we can plant a church with you. You know, Baptists and pedo or child Baptists can't really plant a church together. As soon as somebody gets saved, you got to decide what to do with their kids. It's two different forms of the church. And so they got to go their separate ways. And the Knotts and Hall sailed away, and they're out of their lives. All of New England was grieved. But I haven't mentioned Harriet and Samuel Newell. They were very dear to the Judsons. Harriet Newell was a teenager. She was 19. She was Nancy's best friend. I mean, they had become dear, dear friends through all of this. And they were Congregationalists. They were not convinced. And they got a ship and sailed away to the Isle of France, which today is called Mauritius. Harriet was 19. She was pregnant with the Newell's first child. As they arrived at Mauritius, Harriet went into labor, and just as they were about to debark, mother and baby died. And the next time Anne or Nancy gets any word of her friend, she has died with her baby. But God sent them encouragement, and that encouragement was Luther Rice. Luther Rice had sailed on the Harmony, and there were British missionaries on the Harmony, British Baptist missionaries. These Baptists had sailed out of America because they couldn't get a ship out of England to the East India Company. So they were sort of trying to do an end around. And they said to Rice, you need to study the baptism thing. And when he got to Calcutta, he had become convinced of believer's baptism by immersion. And it's like, oh no, how can I tell Judson this? And when he told him, they were overjoyed. Rice as well was baptized by the Serampore missionaries. Rice was a single man. And he didn't really, he had a little bit poor health. And so they discussed it and decided that, you know what, we need support from the Baptists. Why don't you go home, rally the Baptists, because we don't have anybody sending us checks right now, and we're living in India. So go home and rally support, and then come back and join us. Rice is another great story. All right, and we could spend an hour on Rice, because he's going to get to America, and in 2 years, he's going to travel between the 48 Baptist associations in America. He's going to travel all the way out to the Mississippi. He's going to put 250,000 miles on his horse before he dies. His old faithful horse that he talked about all the time. And the Baptists, in what has to be a second-order miracle, if we're talking up second-order miracles, set aside their differences and agree to come together for this one great cause. And they form a Baptist society to support the Judsons. Now, the Judsons have to go for nearly 2 years with no support. And the biographers are pretty unclear as to how they survived. They survived. Judson didn't take a job. They survived. I think people were generous with them. But the Baptists established the General Missionary Convention of the Baptist denomination in the United States for foreign missions. And they decided that it would meet every 3 years, so it got shortened to triennial convention. Rice, for the next 22 years, is going to travel all over America, raising support for the Judsons, for other causes, for Columbia University, for you name it. Rice is the greatest fundraiser until modern times when it's become an art. Now that's my story. But I still have 20 minutes. And so let me just summarize for you their life work. But I have to summarize it. So I'm going to urge you to read some books. In fact, I'm going to include the books in the PowerPoint. And I hope you will read these, so you'll get so much more detail than I can show. Between 1812 and June 1813, they find themselves as Baptist missionaries in a country that forbids all missionaries. And what's going on between America and England right now? The War of 1812 has broken out. Now, they didn't anticipate that when they sailed. But the War of 1812 has broken out. And so these American missionaries are not only in a situation that is completely untenable, they're not allowed to be missionaries, but there's war going on and the British want to arrest them, and you'll have to read the biographies because they evade arrest repeatedly, repeatedly. It's cloak and dagger stuff, but they keep surviving. Nancy, meanwhile, gets pregnant and loses their first child. These are incredibly dark days. They have no support. They don't know where to go. He said, why don't they just go to Serampore? Because they visited Serampore. And it's British, and it's a well-oiled machine. I mean, Serampore's got massive printing press and all kinds of missionary endeavors and education. Adoniram looks at that and says, they need me like they need a hole in the head. I mean, I got to go someplace where God has called me. But they didn't know where. And they sailed to Mauritius, found out what had happened to the Newells. Mauritius was a plantation island where the slave owners would not allow missions to slaves. Judson was so frustrated by that, he sailed back to India. And then finally, when they were about to be arrested, there was a ship sailing to Rangoon. He had dreamed about Burma for years. All his friends said, don't go to Burma. Burma's deadly. I mean, they're not like the Hindus. Hindus are nice people, and even though they don't get saved, they'll smile and listen to you and feed you and be kind to you. These Buddhists, they think they're superior to you. They think their religion is more advanced, and they won't listen, and they'll kill you. And Judson said, you know, you're probably right, we shouldn't go there. And then they evaded arrest for the last time, and the ship going out of harbor was going to Rangoon, and Judson said, well, I think it's the Lord's will. Yes! Always wanted to go to Burma. And they arrived in June of 1813, and there's Rangoon in what is now Myanmar. And their first sight sailing up to Rangoon was the Shwedagon Pagoda, one of the wonders of the Eastern world, this massive Buddhist temple that just dominated the whole region. And Burma was a tough place to serve. The Buddhist religion was not a tolerant religion. Burma was an advanced society. They had their own literature. They had a large, well-educated, they probably had a higher percentage of educated people than a lot of countries around the world. Furthermore, it had a population that was nearly four times the population of the United States at the time. I mean, it's a large country. They're arrogant. For centuries, they have been virtually undefeated in battle in their region. Everywhere they've turned, they have won. They call themselves the golden scepter, the golden throne, the golden country, and they think everybody is inferior to them. And as Judson meets these people and starts evangelizing, he gets no response. Carey was 7 years before he saw his first convert. Judson is going to be six. But he studies the Burmese language. It is a very difficult language. It lacks concepts like sin. It's really, really hard to translate. But within 4 years, he has mastered Burmese to the point that he's translated the Gospel of Matthew. Dr. Larry Oates, who I teach with out at Maranatha, has visited Myanmar on several occasions. One of the trips in the early 2000s, when I had just become a colleague, he came back and somehow he had legally procured a Gideon Bible. And the Gideon Bible that was given him in Burma is Judson's translation. That is nearly 300 years later, they're still carrying Judson's translation. It was a magnificent translation, and there's a page of it. I can't even tell where Burmese sentences begin and end. I mean, it is an incredibly squiggly language. There it is. I know one word on that page. Yeah. Well, God gives them a little boy in 1815 whom he names Roger Williams. Remember, he's been a Baptist now for a couple years, so we're naming our son Roger Williams. And the little boy dies at age 7 months, breaking their hearts. The climate was just incredibly difficult. So, summarizing, 6 years of evangelism, translation, day-to-day interactions. He built a little study place like Buddhist philosophers did called a zayat, and he would just invite people to join him as they were walking down the road. Lots of opposition that I must not pause to cover, but interested people, they liked talking to him, but nobody would face the persecution that would come from getting saved. And then finally, 1819, in the summertime, Mong Nao, fairly low class, a laborer, working man. He's been sitting in a little circle listening to the teaching just like the other Buddhists, and they all ask questions, and they listen, and they're polite. And then he comes to him after one of the meetings and said, Master Judson, I've believed in Jesus. Judson so much didn't believe it that he basically grilled him. And he spent a long time challenging him and trying to talk him out of being a Christian. But he couldn't. And on June 27th, 1819, he baptized Mong Nao in a little pond near the mission. And notice what's just happened there. A believer has been baptized by immersion. And a New Testament church has been started in Burma. Well, the rest of the story, as I wrap up, Judson was arrested during a war between England and Burma. He spent 17 months in prison. He wasn't British. He kept telling them he wasn't British, but he was white, and that was enough. And this prison experience was utterly brutal. He came very near dying numerous occasions and heroically ministered to him during these months. Got pregnant again, carried a little girl, bore her while he was in prison. He finally gets out when the war ends. He's reunited with Maria, their daughter, and with Nancy, his wife. And then Nancy gets sick and dies. She's 36 years old, and their little daughter Maria dies at age 2.5 just shortly thereafter. And Judson's alone. And he's brokenhearted, but there's opportunity for ministry. Because when the English defeated the Burmese in battle, they basically occupied the lower half of Burma, told the king of Burma, if we want to, we can conquer your whole country, but we don't want to. But we're going to hold on to this southern part so you'll behave yourself. And that's kind of what the British Empire did. It was not an empire of occupation. It was an empire of go in, establish relations, establish a military presence, and then steal all their stuff. All right? That's how the British Empire became really powerful and wealthy. They didn't really want fighting all over the place. And so they fought just enough to humble the Burmese. And then Judson now is living in this southern part of the country, in this new city they built called Amherst. And he's working on his translation, and he's trying to build his little church. And I didn't put it up here, but the Burmese before the war were incredibly arrogant. After an army of about 3,000 English sails up the Irrawaddy and destroys an army of 100,000 Burmese, they were much humbler. And God used that to cause them to be open to the gospel. And dozens of these Burmese are getting saved and added to the church. Judson finishes the Burmese Bible by 1834. He's going to continue to edit it for the rest of his life. But it's a tremendous achievement. If you would like to know more about Anne, and you should like to know more about Anne, Sharon James, an excellent scholar, has written, My Heart is in His Hands, Anne Judson of Burma. I recommend that to you. She's a lady who wrote it for ladies. Men, you will get a great blessing from reading it. Tremendous book. In 1834, Judson married a missionary widow. She and her husband, George Dana Boardman, had traveled over to minister to the mountain Burmese, a tribe called the Karen. And they were impacting the Karen and seeing souls saved. And then George developed tropical disease and died. Most widows of these missionaries would go home, not Sarah. Sarah said, I've learned the Karen language. I've learned Burmese. Why would I want to leave? And she carries on as a single woman in the jungle for 5 years. Shocking everybody. Women don't do that. You don't send single women to the mission field at this time. And Judson and she correspond. Initially, Judson wrote her and said, listen, I know what it's like to lose a spouse. I'm here for you if you ever need anything. And then she wrote to him and said, I've read your Burmese Bible. What a translation. I've been so moved by it. She said, I'm glad I learned Burmese just so I could read your translation. I've never been so moved by the scriptures. And Judson said, hey, maybe we could get together and talk. And they got married. And she was an incredible missionary helper. Married for 11 years. She bore him 8 children during those 11 years. Every one of them is a story. A lot of sorrow, but a lot of joy. Sarah's health begins to fail. And in 1845, they sail for America. On the way there, Sarah dies. She doesn't make it home to see her family. She's buried at St. Helena, which is famous as the burial place of Napoleon Bonaparte. That is, St. Helena is an island west of Africa in the Atlantic. You sail around Cape of Good Hope and you come to St. Helena. Well, they first stuck Napoleon on an island where he could come back. This time they stuck him on an island where he'd never get back. And he died there and was buried in St. Helena. So is Sarah Judson. If I were visiting an island, I'd want to see her grave. And he went to America. He's now a famous missionary. He had no idea he was a famous missionary. But his wife, Anne, had written a number of journals that had been published. And the Judsons were just nationally famous. And he met an author, a young lady named Emily Chubbuck. She wrote by the name of Fanny Forrester. And she was a really good writer for the standards of the time. But she was writing kind of penny-ante fun stuff, you know, just not religious literature, just fun stories. And Judson meets her and says, are you a Christian? And she says, oh, yes, sir. I love the Lord. He says, then why are you writing all that drivel? You need to devote your pen to serving the Lord. And she said, well, I have a real poor family, and the income was helping us support it. He says, oh, that's fine. But let me give you a chance to write something good. My wife, Sarah, was a really godly woman. Would you write her biography? And she says, I would be honored to do that. And so Judson started meeting with this 29-year-old young lady and having interviews about his wife, Sarah. And they became good friends. They became very good friends. And on June 2nd, they got married, which was considered a scandal at the time. Judson was in his late 50s. You know, Judson had been through a lot by this time and could not have cared less what people think. All right, that is, this is a godly woman. And by the way, she was well prepared to go back to Burma with him. And they did. They sailed back to Burma a month later. And if you would like to read Fanny Forrester's biography of Sarah B. Judson, it has been reprinted not too long ago. And that's the reprint. And it's not a real easy read because good style back then is not good style now, but it is a great story. The story of Sarah Judson is amazing. There's one more thing that Judson wants to accomplish, and that is he wants to finish his Burmese English dictionary. Why? Because his translation will need to be improved. And so people need to, missionaries who come to the land need these tools. It's a huge endeavor. But he keeps working on it, and he finishes it. And his health begins to fail. Emily is caring for him, but he is a sick man. And what they typically did in these tropical climates is when you get ill, you go get on a ship and you sail out to sea where the sea breezes can heal you. He had done that a number of times in the past to recover his health. They said, that's your only chance. Emily would have gone with him, but she was pregnant with their child. And he died at sea, April 12, 1850, and was buried there off the Burmese coast. He was 61 years old. Emily now had, she had actually borne him another child, and she had also adopted several of his children. His children is complicated. He fathered 13 children. And by the three different wives, and when I teach his whole story, I number the children and try to keep track of them. It's very tricky. But Emily and the kids went home, but just her 4 years living in Rangoon and Amherst had so compromised her health that she died of tuberculosis at the age of 36. There's Emily Chubbuck Judson. If you want the whole story told really, really, really well, read To the Golden Shore by Courtney Anderson. I believe it is the most dynamic and exciting biography in all of missions lore. Now, there's some other great ones, but I warmly recommend that one. What is the legacy of Adoniram Judson? Well, I'll talk about the legacy in a moment. Do you have any questions about his life? Yes, ma'am. What did I leave out? So the three wives are, oh yes, there's a great book that I did not include. The Three Mrs. Judsons. Yes, it's an older book, but it's devoted exclusively to each of the wives. And that book is really well written. The Three Mrs. Judsons. Now, it comes under various titles, but if you look for Three Mrs. Judsons, you'll find it. Arabella Stewart was the author of that book. And again, Arabella Stewart wrote it to encourage women in ministry. Anybody can read it and profit greatly. Thank you. Other questions or comments? All right, a few lessons. Baptist missions in Burma are a tangible result of Judson's ministry. By the time he died, there were over 60 churches in Burma. There were nearly 7,000 converts. Say, yeah, but Burma, Myanmar is still a Buddhist country. Well, yeah, it is. But God did a work in Burma in the 19th century. You may not have heard of Francis Mason, Eugenio Kincaid, Julius Vinton. These were missionaries from America who came in, served alongside Judson, and then launched fantastic ministries. Missions thrived in Burma like nowhere else in Asia throughout the 19th century. The only country that comes close is China. And really, the mission heyday in China is going to be early 20th century. Also, he produced the Burmese Bible. You know, I love William Carey. I hate to say anything negative about William Carey. He's one of my favorite people in church history. Such a gentle soul. But Carey and his team had one goal. Get the Bible into as many indigenous translations as possible in one generation. And they produced translations into every language from Persia to China in 30 years. It's an incredible accomplishment. None of those translations were still being used 50 years later. That is, they were all very rapid works. Why? Because they just wanted to get them out there. Every time a missionary moved into an area, like Henry Martin went into Persia, well, he very quickly discovered that there were all kinds of bad renderings in the translation, and he had to do a new one. And Morrison did a new one in China. They actually did a Burmese translation that Judson found completely useless. So there's a way to do translation, and that is get it out there as quickly as possible. And there's something to be said for that, because literally millions of people were exposed to the gospel. Judson did not take that approach. He pored over his translation. And as I mentioned, it's still being carried in Burma today. A couple of modern translations have been made. They use more modern Burmese, but they're not more accurate than Judson's. an incredible thing. Burma is now Myanmar. It's Buddhist and politically oppressive. Nevertheless, there are an estimated 3.5 million Christians in Burma. Revival is ongoing among the Karen. Cool thing. There is a large Karen population in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. A number of those Karen have come to Christ and have put their kids in a Christian school that supports Maranatha. And this, as of last year, we have 2 Karen students enrolled at school. In fact, I think both of them are in my Heritage class right now. 15% of the Karen consider themselves Christians. That is an enormously high percentage for an Asian people group. And the largest Christian group among the Karen are, in fact, Baptists. One of my former students, who was a little bit of a nut, I mean, I'm not endorsing, he traveled to Cambodia and then illegally crossed the Burmese line and went up in the mountains and met the Karen. And he came back with stories about the Karen. And I said, Bill, what are you doing? But that was Bill. But he said the love for the Lord among these Karen Baptists is just fantastic. And it goes back to the very first Karen to come to Christ was led to the Lord by Judson. And he supported this mission extensively. Was the providence of God a key in his life and ministry? I think maybe. He could have sailed across the ocean, settled down, been a nice congregationalist minister. Maybe God would have done great things. What God would not have done is planted Baptist churches all over Burma. And I'm thankful for that. Any questions? Oh, yes. Oh, I'm sorry. You're making a statement. Go ahead. Oh, yeah. It's the most Muslim country in the world. Yeah. Amen. Amen. We don't measure a man's faithfulness by his results. God may or may not give results. But praise God when there are results. And there are lasting results. Judson became known as the father of American missions because hundreds and hundreds of men and women were inspired to go to the foreign field when they read the accounts of Adoniram and Nancy and Sarah and Emily, these people who just poured themselves into the work at the cost of their own lives. Yes, sir.
Where did he say he was buried?
He was buried at sea, a few miles off the coast in the Bay of Bengal next to Burma. Yeah, I think it's a memorial. Yeah, it's not his actual tomb. Yeah. But I'm not surprised they built a memorial to him in Plymouth. That was his hometown for a while. Oh, I know. Yeah, it's sad. Let's not start talking about monuments being torn down. I mean, George Whitefield had a statue in the University of Pennsylvania for a long, long time, and then they just took it down because they were embarrassed by him. And we'll talk about Whitefield in Sunday school tomorrow. There's nothing to be embarrassed about Whitefield. I mean, he was flawed. He had his errors, but that was a commercial.